The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to our Friday Space Show program. Great to be here. Beautiful day in the San Francisco area. I hope wherever you are, it is equally as nice. Let's run through our announcements. The first one being that today's program is on the 60-minute format. So if you want to have a question or comment for our two guests, please make sure you get it in early, as we do have an on-time ending planned at 10:30 a.m. California time. Go ahead and adjust that to your local time zone. For those of you who would like to call in and talk to our two guests today, who I will introduce in a minute, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. And if you're at work or you don't have access to your phone, the email is, of course, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Please do remember that The Space Show is a copyrighted and trademarked program, but you do have permission to download our programs and share them. A 90-minute show is roughly 40 megabytes. Please don't do anything commercial with the programs, no edits or cuts for your own website or private YouTube channels or anything of that nature. And we don't permit written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. If you do have any questions about something you might want to do with one of our Space Show programs, please email me at drspace at thespaceshow.com. We do podcast, and we thank Andrew at gigadial.net. He is our podcasting client service. You can find our RSS URL to subscribe to our podcast on our newsletters and on our website. We're also in iTunes, Podcast Alley, AstroSpaceNow.com, YAstro.com, Microsoft, Zoom, and other places around the net. If you have any questions about our podcast, please get a hold of me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. That is our website, thespaceshow.com. So we have a very detailed website newsletter that is uploaded every Sunday evening, and that has all of the details of the week's programming, guest bios, and it's the only place you'll find our future events section. So do check it out, and if you have any questions, please let me hear from you. All of our programs are archived on our website. You can listen to them right off of our site or easily download the show. There's a store. You'll see it on the website in the upper left-hand corner. It's called Space Show Gear. Please check it out. Probably the most important button there is the Support the Space Show. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, and it is your support that keeps us on the air. So please check us out at OneGiantLeapFoundation.org or drop me a note at drspace@thespaceshow.com if you have any questions about our 501c3 status or what we're doing with the Space Show and educational support. And then finally, remember that we are brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, and they do promote cooperative solutions for space security. You can get more information about this great organization at www.swfound.org. They also are the sponsors of our webinar series, and we're working on our next one with them at this time, so more details will be available as soon as Secure World chooses what they want to do for the next webinar topic. And if you have any questions about any of this, please don't hesitate to contact me. The best way to do so is email drspace@thespaceshow.com. Now, normally when I go to the SmallSat conference, which I had to miss this year, I sit down for a 30 or 40 minute taped interview with Stan Kennedy of Oakman Aerospace. But since I was unable to attend SmallSat this year, Stan Kennedy and Maureen O'Brien of Oakman Aerospace, and that is www.oak-aero.com, are our guests with us live today. This is the first time that Stan has ever been on the Space Show live, and it's the first time we've been able to have Maureen sit in and join us for her part of this dynamic company and what we're doing. Stan is has over 27 years of direct hands-on experience in aerospace engineering. He has worked on heavy lift vehicles, upper stages, multiple spacecraft programs, and ground systems supporting government in commercial arenas with their customers, domestic and international. And he is the president and co-founder of Oakman Aerospace, which is in Colorado, and they specialize in rapid and responsive modular open architecture space systems. His full bio is already on the website, so you can read about him there. Maureen O'Brien currently serves as the Director of Space, Trade, and International Affairs for Oakman Aerospace. With over 15 years of experience in the aerospace industry in the areas of modeling and simulation, mission analysis, security, program management, and ITAR export control, in her current position with Oakman Aerospace, she is overseeing the commercial and international business aspects of Oakman Aerospace. And again, the company is a specialty company in rapid and responsive modular open architecture space systems. She has been heavily involved in supporting the current ITAR regime reforms that are going on, and we will be hearing from her in a few minutes about what is happening with ITAR and how it affects a dynamic growth company such as Oakman. So Stan and Maureen, welcome to the Space Show Live today. How are you both?
David, thank you for inviting us on and doing well.
Great. And Maureen, welcome as well. It's nice to have you on the show with us this year, too.
Yes, thank you very much. Appreciate being here.
So, Stan, from when you were on last year with us at SmallSat, Oakman was sort of just starting, right, because of some changes with Comcast Aero Astro, right?
Yeah, actually, I think we were going to do an interview last year, and we actually had to postpone that because of the transition that was
That's right,
place.
So we had to cancel it.
It's been a couple of years since we last sat and talked, and there's been quite a bit of change over the last 2 years.
Well, update us, please.
Oh, most definitely. So as you mentioned, right about SmallSat last year, last July, Comtech Telecommunications Corporation, our parent company of Comtech Aero Astro, ceased operations for the small satellite business. At the time, I had been in the position of Senior Vice President and General Manager of Commercial, Civil, and International Programs. And due to the sequestration of some of the unknowns in program and program funding, they had decided to exit the business. We still had contractual commitments and other things that needed to take place, so I took it upon myself to found Oakman Aerospace, co-founded it with my father, Stan Kennedy Sr., and we basically work an asset purchase and sales agreement to pick up intellectual properties and equipment in replace for the lease liabilities and some of the other things that were associated with the current contractual commitment that Comtech Aero Astro. So it was a busy time last July, August. Since then, we've finished out our commercial test facility here in Littleton, Colorado, and we've got our clean room up and running, our commercial test facility with multiple modular test beds up and running. We just closed out our first year and did very, very well.
What is the actual nature of the business of Oakman now?
So when we were previous to Comtech Aero Astro, or while we were at Comtech Aero Astro, we were doing small satellites. We were also doing space systems components and missions and payloads. The component line of business for Aero Astro actually transitioned to Space Micro out in San Diego, Dave Strobel and Dave Chakowski's organization, and they are actually still offering those components as part of their list. What we picked up on, we actually maintained all of the modular spacecraft systems and some of the mission and payload and data distribution services that we had as part of Comtech AeroAstro. So our focus is on modular open system architecture systems using space plug-and-play compliant configurations. And again, I think that there's, with the things that have taken place over the last year, year and a half, with a lot of the standards now being published through AIAA and the commercial aspect starting to take off from a cost savings perspective, there's been a lot of activity of both domestic and international collaboration in the modular open architecture systems arena.
Government activity, or is this purely commercial now?
Actually, there's both. I'm sure that most of the listeners are familiar with the Operationally Responsive Space Office. The MSV, the Modular Space Vehicle, efforts are continuing down there. We don't actually directly support that, but we are supporting AFRL, the Air Force Research Lab, with some of the advanced plug-and-play technologies, follow-on activities. So the precursors to modular open architecture systems was TACSAT-5 and the Advanced Plug-and-Play Technologies Testbed. And we still are maintaining some of those interactions with the Air Force Research Lab. So that's kind of on the government side. And then on the on the DOD side of the house, on the government, there's civil work going on up at Ames. Ames is doing a number of cooperative research efforts, both domestic and international, in the CubeSat and some of the mission areas. And then there's a number of commercial activities that we're dealing with via master service agreements with our international partners in Canada, Sweden, the UK, Italy, and other places.
So in the past year, have you seen a solid grounding in the small satellite commercial side of things, like we were talking before the show started? And you said that this year, SmallSat, because of sequestration, you were seeing commercial deals being made. And how do you assess this new market? Is it really coming about and taking shape?
Yeah, I did. I saw a noticeable change at this year's SmallSat, and to a lesser extent, but still visible, back in April at the National Space Symposium. Obviously, sequestration has put limits on what the government are out looking for, and one of the casualties, at least in the early parts of the sequestration, were some of the science and technology missions. You know, they're focusing more on the operational needs and making sure that the existing systems are funded to continue to provide the services that are required by the Air Force and other agencies within the U.S. government. What we saw at NSS was a lot more industry-to-industry collaboration and trying to figure out where the adjacent markets and maybe new greenfield opportunities were. And that continued at AIAA SmallSat. There were a number of startups. There were a number of new ventures. And I'm sure that, again, lots of your listeners are familiar with all of the activities that are going on with things like crowdsource funding and SmallSat. And because of the lower cost or barrier of entry for 3U and 6U CubeSats there, and the technology capabilities of those are coming up very quickly, it makes them appealing for lower cost commercial activities.
You actually have a question about that, and this is from Carl, who's in San Jose, California, and he actually says, I was at the recent New Space Conference in July, and the crowdsourcing and small satellite opportunities that are being planned, talked about, being worked on Kickstarter, are growing by leaps and bounds. I have no idea if any of them will be successful or not, but I've never been to a conference before where there seemed to be so much commercial activity and money being thrown into various CubeSat programs for almost any purpose you can imagine. Is that the same thing you're talking about when you talk about small satellites and the SmallSat conference? Are these companies all the same?
Yeah, I think there's a mix. Some of the same companies are providing those services for the Kickstarts. The interesting part of the Kickstarts is they're commercially based. There are academic based systems that are getting Kickstart funding. I know that Jamie Cutler out at University of Michigan is working on some source funding for a deep space 3U or 6U CubeSat for deep space monitoring. That would be the first CubeSat to go outside of the Earth's orbit. So it is. There's many, many opportunities out there, and because of the lower cost of the CubeSats and the ability to get them launched at somewhat regular intervals through some of the ride-sharing opportunities, there's going to be, I think, a continued push to have more and more of these things move forward in the very near future.
I'm looking on your website, and you do list launch segments mostly for integration, but are you also helping to find rides for opportunities? Is that also part of what you're doing?
You know, we do. We don't necessarily provide the launch services or the launch integration activities. We've done that in the past. One of the things that we are working very closely with is being able to do integrations on the commercial systems that have excess capability. ULA also has a number of capabilities to fly secondaries on some of their upcoming missions for the U.S. government. And then there's a number of international launch vehicles that are available. And as I think when we transition into the discussion on some of the ITAR and export control reform updates, Maureen can give you the background on that, but it's allowing more of these collaborative efforts to take place and do it much more efficiently via Commerce Department versus State Department in the future. So, I definitely agree that the Kickstarts are alive and well, and there's going to be lots of successes there. And I also think that there's a number of industrial consortiums that are coming together because SmallSats now make it affordable to be able to provide some of those closed systems for particular missions of interest.
Ben sent in an email, and he says, this is cryptic, I'm someplace near Hawthorne, so we'll just leave it at that. Ben says, many of us believe that the sequestration is an absolute godsend for the commercial industry, and it's probably the best thing that Congress has done in years and years and years. Do you see silver and gold linings from sequestration in terms of the benefits that are going to flow and the positive changes coming out of the need to look commercial?
Yeah, I guess I always, it's a double-edged sword. I think that our government is realizing that they need to become more efficient. They need to more fully embrace commercial best practices. There's a reason why our capital assets for our U.S. government cost what they cost. They need to be there and they need to work. And so we definitely have to have those systems. There's a mixed fleet approach where you can balance those exquisite assets with commercial or maybe shorter duration or more science and technology missions in a mixed fleet approach that can help reduce total life cycle costs of the operational system. So I think that the government's getting it. I still think that in the short term, they're going to be focused on completing the current missions and mission objectives, which is going to take money away from some of the smaller organizations that would typically do the S&T type missions. But what that's then doing is it's forcing the commercial folks to get together and see more opportunity from a green field or, like I said, the adjacent markets perspective for commercial opportunities in low Earth orbit and other places.
So you started Oakman at a time when economic conditions were clearly less than stellar, so to speak. So How has it been in your first year? Is it surpassing your goals and your estimates of what you had been doing? Is it a day-to-day struggle? How have you really done in the first year, given all what's been going on in the country and the economy?
Yeah, actually, like you said, July of last year, with everything going the way it was, there were people that were exiting the business, and so it's kind of like, why would you want to be starting up in that environment?
Right.
The Oakman's business model is, again, I think a new way of looking at it. We have 8 employees. We've got 5,000 square feet of test facilities here, and we're focusing on modular open architecture systems and being able to test performance there. Because of where the IP that we picked up in terms of the analytical modeling and the tools that we use to design our missions and design our customer requirements, needs, and things like that, we can do things that traditional large companies would have done in the past with a much lower overhead and operating cost associated with it. So what it's allowed us to do is, over the first year, it was a struggle. We pushed really, really hard to get our capabilities back up and getting the infrastructure in place as a new company. We've gotten that done. We finished out our fiscal year, actually ended July 31st. So we completed our first year, and we did just over $2 million of revenue. And to date, and you can ask Maureen this, I think we're still making payroll, and we got money in the bank. So I'm very upbeat about the future, and we're going to keep pushing forward with kind of the new ways of doing business and give it a ride.
In doing the space show, I'm seeing a definite uptick in the interest with companies located outside America. So maybe, Maureen, you can field this. I guess if the companies want to bring things into America, it's probably easier to work with than you're trying to take our technology to work with someone outside of the country. But I'm really seeing a big interest jump in outside America interest in doing international ventures in space with American companies. Is that getting easier to do? How do you assess that?
I guess I wouldn't say it's easier just yet. Currently, the current situation, for those who aren't familiar with it, is anything space-related is controlled on the United States munitions list. No ifs, ands, or buts. And it requires a certain amount of licensing and approvals from the Department of State to be able to sell any spacecraft or spacecraft components, et cetera, overseas. That being said, we are in a time of proposed reform. They haven't taken effect yet, but they are promising first steps in making it easier for companies to work overseas. There are still, obviously, gates to go through, but they're more, I think, I don't want to say efficient, but they're more conducive to doing commercial business overseas with international companies. As you said, it is easier for them to come this way with their items. However, in order to discuss with them any technology, adding any value to their technology, that sort of thing, you still need all the licensing. So it's a work in progress, I think, as far as making it easier. That being said, you know, it's worth it.
What
we've been saying.
What are the bottlenecks? Why are the proposed reforms not yet real reforms?
There was a bit of time that was taken to write a report. It's called the 1248 report, on all the things that the government saw that could be reformed, and they were comfortable with reforming at this point in time. That took a bit of time to get out, and that was fielded, and folks read it. Since then, language went into the NDAA, and it went out for public comment. Those public comments closed on, I believe it was about July 8th of this year. And now all those public comments are available to view on the Federal Registry website. And what's going to happen with that is the government's going to look through that. They're going to either say, yes, we agree with those comments. These changes are, you know, made based on those type of comments. Or I think we have a plan to move forward. We're going to put that into law. And that should happen sometime next year. So it's just, you know, it's the
bureaucracy,
pace of government, yeah, and getting things passed. But you know, that being said, it is the reform is a very good first step. It's a very promising good first step. There are some items, obviously, that smaller companies and others would have liked to seen happen, but. But the fact that the government is looking at this and they're willing to start working with industry to make international business a viable item, it's really great news.
How important is ITAR reform to Oakman Aerospace? Is this a big, big, big deal or a nice thing to have happen? How would you rate it?
I would say, yeah, it's on the high end from a 1 to 10. It's pushing 10. as we've been saying all along, working with the government these days is difficult with funding. Typically, smaller businesses are considered second and third tier suppliers in government industry, and that's fine. Internationally, though, being able to team and create partnerships with other companies and do things as a team versus, you know, the standard prime subcontractor roles, those sort of things. It makes it more interesting and more profitable for all those involved. So it's a big deal to small companies, I believe, especially.
I've got four questions here from people listening. They're all students in various undergrad, graduate, and even one high school student. So I'm lumping them all together, and you can probably guess the question. Do you accept interns?
Do we accept interns?
Or do you have internship programs?
We do, and I'm going to let Stan talk a little bit about that since he's the approval authority on those.
Okay.
David, we do have interns. In our first year of operations, we actually had two high school interns in, and I'm a very big proponent of science, technology, engineering, and math outreach. As you know, I'm the
right
student competition tech chair at AIAA SmallSat, and so, you know, trying to invigorate the next generation of scientists, engineers, and mathematicians, technologists is near and dear to my heart. So, yeah, we are always looking for opportunities to continue to increase the intern capabilities. I thought where the question might be going, especially with the discussion on ITAR, would have been more on the how do we not only attract STEM engineering and math students to undergraduate, graduate, and postgraduate programs, but how do we maintain or be able to entice foreign students that are here studying to stay and actually enter into the workforce, because as a lot of people know, we train the world's engineers in the United States, and then we make it very, very difficult for them to obtain green card and be able to participate quickly in ITAR-controlled data. So one of the things that Maureen and I have both been working on with Senator Bennett's office and Congressman Mike Kaufman, both in the state of Colorado, they've been proponents and also pushed the NDAA language. They are also working the immigration reform document or what's the bills that are going through Congress right now. And those have language in them that will help to maintain or to keep foreign students that graduate in the engineering and sciences is to stay in the U.S. and make it easier for them to get green cards and be able to quickly support small companies like Oakman as well as the large companies that have been in business for many, many years.
If a student is interested in an internship with your company, what do? They contact you, write you a letter, pick up the phone?
Yeah, I mean, from a perspective of that, the best thing to do is go onto the website, and there's an info at Oak-Aero, and just send the request there.
Okay. You got another question. Let's see. This is from Charles Pooley, who has micro launchers in. I've been trying to get Charles to go to SmallSat ever since I discovered SmallSat 10 or 12 years ago, but one of these days. Anyway, Charles is in Las Vegas, and he says, are all CubeSats still tied up to arranging secondary payloads? Wow. I think he means how. How much does that cost, and how long? I guess he means how long. Remember I told you I had to edit emails on the fly?
No, that's okay.
How long does it take from contract to launch?
Again, I think that's very, very specific on what the CubeSat is, where it's built, and where it's trying to fly to. I think trying to get back to the question that came out of it, but scheduling CubeSat, especially with now they've got a lot of the standard launch container and the launch integration activities for those CubeSats is starting to get easier. There's NASA's program, the Alana program that does CubeSat integration through the Cape. There, obviously, SpaceX has a lot of reserve capability on their Falcon 9s, and there's almost a standard pricing that Jason Andrews and Spaceflight are proposing to do integration activities, you know, standard integration activities of CubeSat. Again, from a commodity perspective, by forcing or by result or dropping down into a standard for 3U or a 6U, it opens up a lot of opportunities to get lower cost rides because of the standard interfaces. It also then, you know, you've got to fit more and more mission and more capability into a smaller package. So I think there's a lot of launch opportunities that are coming up not only in the U.S. but internationally. I also think that you're going to see many, many more of the standard launch adapter interfaces, you know, the 3Us, the 6Us, the 15-inch light motorized light band adapters become standard cost models for the commercial satellite launch offerers.
Maureen, I have a question about ITAR for you, okay?
Okay.
This is from Beth, and Beth is in Spokane, Washington. And she says, is it important for citizens who know about ITAR and those of us in the space community to send letters and pound their members of Congress for ITAR reform? Do you think it really matters? Is it too late now because the comment period is already closed? Or do you recommend that we still stay vigilant to try to get these changes approved?
No, absolutely. You know, the current changes look that are proposed are looking very promising to be approved. But one of the things we want to ensure as a community is that it remains an iterative process. You know, technology obviously moves way faster than any government, and we want to ensure that as technology changes and rest of world is in similar technology areas, that we aren't holding things that we don't need to hold as ITAR controlled anymore. You know, if it's available in the rest of the world, you know, we need to ensure that we're out there and able to openly compete on the market. So it's, you know, anytime any comments to your congressmen, to your senators, pushing on reform and to keep the ball rolling is absolutely a good idea.
What do you guys plan for your year two, or is it a continuation of what you've been doing apparently successfully in year one, or do you have any major changes in your focus coming up?
Yeah, I guess I don't think we have major changes in the focus. The way we've set up, you know, our business is primarily commercial and actually commercial international focus. We have signed multiple master service agreements with partners in a number of countries. We continue to push out into the international markets. We think that there's good opportunity there. I will never say no to a government contract if it makes sense, but you got to take those as they come in terms of where the cost benefit is in those systems. So I think we're on target. Like I said, the first year of operations was getting infrastructure set up and making sure that we had the right strategy going forward and reestablishing a lot of the business contacts and master service agreements with our customers that we had already developed in the past. We want to continue to do that and grow that out. And we're also looking for, you know, most of the stuff we do is focused predominantly in Europe through either ESTEC, ESA, Kinest, those relationships that we've developed over time. But I think there's a tremendous opportunity and the right business environments for potential teaming with folks in the Pacific Rim. Singapore is doing a lot of work. Taiwan's doing a lot of work with Formosat and other things. The Indonesians, there's just a lot of opportunity in the Pacific Rim that I think would be a good growth pattern for any small aerospace company in the U.S.
Excellent. And if we take your company out to, I'm sure you probably have something like a five-year plan or something like that. Where do you see Oakman 5 years from now or starting year six? So you would have completed five full years.
So we did complete our strategic long-range operating plan end of last year, so in July. And our growth is modest. We started out, we ended the first year with eight people. We'll probably be double that at the end of next year. I don't foresee us getting to, you know, everybody says, well, you're going to grow it out to 300 people and sell it or do something like that. I think of Oakman as probably more as a services and making smart buyers of some of the commercial activities that are out there. So I think we stabilize out probably in the 30 to 50 range. And then as we develop additional lines of business or product lines, those could actually take off from a production perspective. So I don't see, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people. I see modest growth up to, you know, 30, 50. If it goes beyond that, that would be fantastic. But again, it's been kind of fun working small and being able to be a little bit selective in what you need to do. It's easier to feed eight mouths than it is to feed 300. And coming from some of the companies that I've worked with in the past, you know, our payroll falls out of their pockets on the weekend.
Do you have plans to be a public company someday, or are you planning to stay private?
David, I've learned to say never say never. I'll tell you a story, won't name names, but so in August, we had just signed the asset agreement, the thing that we worked out with CMTL, the asset purchase and sales agreement. And we, you know, were scrambling. We were working many, many hours a day trying to get everything up and running and, you know, doing everything from cleaning windows to washing floors and everything in between. And I got a phone call from one of the folks that I've known for years and years and years in the aerospace industry, and they came out right out and asked. They said, are you ready for merger and acquisition? And I had to tell them at that point it wasn't worth anything. And it really wasn't. It was the intellectual property that were in the people's heads. Now, over the last year, we've developed out that the intellectual property continued to develop that out, and I think we have a good product and a good product brand. So over the years, that's going to be what puts value into Oakman and makes the decision on if it's ready to go public or if it's ready to go into, you know, an mergers and acquisition phase of the program. So you never want to discount that, but I'd probably say even today we're probably a little still too early to entertain those types of discussions. But like I said, never say never.
So what I take from that is that your IP is going to be probably your most valuable asset. Is that a fair assessment, or did I miss something?
I think some of the tools that we have, we did when we did the long-range plan, currently in our first year of operations and kind of where we're going in our second year, we are fairly heavily service-oriented. But as we are developing out our products, those products are then going to then balance out those service capabilities that we have today. So if we had to put a number on it now, we're probably, 75-25 services versus products. At the end of the 5 years, it's going to be more balanced. In fact, it may even tip, depending on how some of the open architecture products move forward. So again, it's a blend today, but it's not balanced quite perfectly yet. I think as we develop out those products and put them out onto the market, especially for commoditized spacecraft components and services, that's where you're going to see some of the benefit and some of the growth.
Here's a question for either of you from Jack in Chicago. And he says, I pay attention to what is happening in the SmallSat, CubeSat type of community. And here is my concern. You've got a product capability that has very little in the way of barriers to entry. College students, sometimes even high school students, can do CubeSats. People can even buy kits or make them themselves. Of course, the launch still remains a question. I see that when you have an industry where there's very little in the way of barriers to entry, everybody can jump in, but then it gets saturated real quickly, and most of what people jump in with doesn't work, which overall hurts the industry. So you end up having a big pullback, sort of, and then those that survive can continue to build it in a more traditional building business sense and make sense of it and make the industry grow, but there is a shaking out period. Do you see that happening in the industry that you're in? Do you have competition? Is this going to be a saturated industry?
There's always a potential for that. And again, the interesting part of the business model and what basically started out, 8-10 years ago with the Integrated Systems Engineering Team, the precursor to the Operationally Responsive Space Office, was a push to standardize interfaces, standardize buses, or the 3Us, 6Us, 12Us, that kind of stuff, but also a standard for the systems and the operating systems that these spacecraft utilize. I think that's going to continue, and what that does is that commoditizes the market, as your caller in said, and it makes it more important to be able to then, how do you provide that commoditized product for best value? And that tends to favor smaller, lower capital-intensive systems or groups that can be able to provide those services, but it also then favors the innovators, and I think that that's one of the things that we're pushing for, and that's where the intellectual property tends to come into play in how do you offer those services and how do you innovate on those open systems to provide value add to the end customer. And yes, there will be many people that come into it and say, well, yeah, we should be able to do this because all you got to do is read the standard or the spec, or I buy a component or I buy a system. But it also, space is a hard business. And learning from the companies that we've all come from in the past, but then taking those lessons and applying them to a commoditized product and making it a business case, I think will separate the winners from the losers. And, that's what we're betting on, and we'll give it a good ride. And, hopefully you have us back in a couple of years and we can say it either worked or we're on to the next one.
Well, hopefully I'll be back at SmallSat next year, and we'll be. And if you're there, we'll be able to sit down and chat. I have an email backed up for you, and I have a phone caller for you. So let's go to the caller first. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you, please?
Charles.
Hi. So this is Charles in Las Vegas, who sent in the email question for you a few minutes ago, Stan. Go ahead, Charles.
I'll be going to SmallSat when my budget can stand it, and that is the only reason I have not gone.
One of these days.
What?
I said one of these days.
Exactly. Okay, my earlier email related to the time delay and cost of each arranged secondary payload, and you kind of evaded a straight answer on each. I had heard the average cost is around 80,000 per, and that the average time is around a year from the time you start the process to launch. Is that correspond to what you know of?
You know, that's probably in the ballpark. There's a number of places, like you go on to Spaceflight Now, you know, the Jason Andrews interface that's working, the Falcon Sat interface as well, or Falcon 9 spacecraft or launch vehicle interface, as well as the Russian launch XF capabilities, and there's some standard pricing out there. The timelines are not necessarily for how long it takes to get your CubeSat integrated. It's how long it takes to get all the paperwork through the system that allows you to fly your CubeSat on that piece of
equipment. And I understand that's generally a year or more.
Yes. Yeah, and it's still you know, the planning. The other thing that I think everybody needs to be aware of, especially kind of new entrants, is that flying your CubeSat, getting it up there is one thing, and then making sure that you've got the frequency allocations to be able to talk to it is another thing.
That's another problem. Yeah.
Right. So again, I think that that favors, and there are a number of companies, obviously, probably yours is one of those, that are looking for alternatives to reduce those cycle times to launch standard payloads or standard interfaces, 1U's, 3U's, 6U's. You're probably very familiar with Super Stripey and what Sandia National Labs is doing. They're working very hard to get the Super Stripey up and running. There are other rail launch systems that are out there that are touting, you know, tens and twenties of kilos of capability to low Earth orbit. And I think as those systems come online and they get their price point correct, they will also have a very good lower entry into the market, which will allow them to maybe take some of those systems that are currently taking a year and $80,000-plus to integrate and even reduce those costs further.
Yeah, not much is mentioned by the about the licensing requirements for RF. My micro-launcher plans involve starting with optical communication only, and that does not require a license. I've checked.
Right.
And then the only way to get something in the space is by cannon slings and whatnot. It will never work for physics reasons. But everybody has his own thing to pitch, I guess. So anyway,
I thank you very much. The
numbers I gave you were what I've been hearing, and I'm glad to hear you kind of confirming it.
Yeah, and like I said, there's a really good, I'm trying to remember what the website is, but if you Google or Bing Spaceflight, there's some standard pricing that's out there for those standard 3U, 6U.
Yeah,
they even go up to...
never take off with those barriers in place. Never.
I'm sorry?
I say the quantity of opportunities to get involved will never go anywhere with those numbers in place.
Yeah, there are opportunities that or there are missions that are willing to pay those dollars.
A few a year, but not hundreds a year.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because there was a couple of really good papers at SmallSat this year that talked about where the backlog of small CubeSats or 3U's, 6U's, those types of systems are, and how many are planned to be launched, and the numbers are staggering. I mean, I think the number was like 150 CubeSats are scheduled to launch in the next 1 to 2 years, something like that.
Yeah, I was told the number waiting was 100, and I wouldn't be surprised if it was near double that now.
Yes, yes.
Until a direct, cheap launch can become available, this is what the situation is going to be for the indefinite future.
Yeah, and again, I think I want to stress to the community, as we have more launch opportunity and as we have more launch on demand, we're going to need to be good stewards of the space commons, as everybody's referring it, and making sure that we're doing good space track and good space planning in terms of where we're putting these things and how long they're going to be up there and how quickly we can get out of the orbit to kind of maintain space debris and further growth of the potential for on-orbit collisions, I think that becomes very, very important. So we're all in this together, and if we have one bad actor that puts things up and cause problems, we got to, you know, that hurts the whole industry.
Yeah, my answer to space debris is to skip low Earth orbit altogether and go straight to escape. I would ask you perhaps to Google the word micro-launchers, and you'll get my answers to that.
Sure.
Thank you, Charles.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye-bye. You've got an email from Bob Muir.
Hey, Bob.
And Maureen, this is for you. He says, for Maureen, where do you see the line being drawn between USML controlled versus CCL controlled technologies, particularly with respect to imaging system aperture size? And Maureen, if you can please decipher the coding for the listeners who don't know what USML controlled, CCL controlled is, that would be helpful. He then goes on to say, do you foresee American companies achieving parity on this metric with foreign suppliers, or will we be still at a disadvantage as compared to European and Asian offerings?
Well, okay, so brief acronym spell out. The USML is the U.S. Munitions List, and that's the state-controlled list. CCL is Commerce Control, and that's kind of what the reform is pointing to right now, is taking things off of the USML list and moving them over to the CCL list that is controlled by the Department of Commerce, making it easier, probably isn't the right word, more streamlined, more efficient to deal internationally with certain products. And as far as, so right now I believe it's a 0.3 meter optic is what is still, or greater, is what still is going to be maintained on the USML list. And then the others go to the CCL list. So that's the line that's drawn. I would say that we will be at a disadvantage. Like I said before, technology moves way, way more quickly than governments and can keep up with. And rest of world is doing very interesting things. And more and more folks are looking to, as Stan said, Asia and the Pacific Rim as far as, you know, their technology leaps and bounds and vice versa. They're starting to team up to come up with new and innovative things because they are not able to work with the United States on certain things. Another thing that is staying on the USML list is, Stan was talking about debris, space situational awareness, spacecraft and mission payloads, et cetera. If it has anything to do with SSA, it stays on the USML list as well, which, again, puts U.S. companies at a disadvantage because this is a global issue, pun intended, that we all need to be looking at. And again, folks are working day and night, weekends, etc., to come up with new and innovative ways to monitor LEO and out to ensure that our systems are safe and don't collide, etc. So I hope I answered the question. I think I got that question.
Okay, Bob, if you're still on and you want to know more, either call us at 1-866-687-7223 or send us another email. We have about 6 minutes or 6.5 minutes left of our program this morning. And for everyone else, yeah, the toll-free is 1-866-687-7223. Don't wait until the last minute to make your call like a couple of you do, but we'd still like to hear from you. You know, it seems to me, and I'm seeing more and more space shuttle programs addressing CubeSats and crowdfunding, even on an international level, and more business concepts. In fact, I'm on one of the business plan competitions as a judge, and probably more than two-thirds of the plans deal with CubeSats and trying to come in on that market. Do you see this growth and interest leveling out? We haven't even touched, you know, the potential of what's available for us. I mean, this is like really exciting, but you wonder, my God, there's so much of it. Is there room for more to come?
Yeah, I guess I'll maybe take a stab at it. I think that there's going to continue to be an increasing demand for the CubeSats. And again, if we can maintain good stewardship of low Earth orbit for these systems and maintain the situational awareness and debris mitigation, that we will continue to see growth in those areas. CubeSats have a couple of things that make them attractive. Obviously, the lower cost allows a less costly barrier of entry to get into the business. But they also, the standard components and the standard capabilities allow innovators and small companies to be able to provide components, mission payloads, piece parts, ground systems, and everything else that go with it. And so, again, I think that the standards are the important part. And before we run out of time, I just wanted to let everybody know that just a week before AIAA SmallSat this year, the AIAA Standards Executive Council released the full set of SPA guidebook and SPA compliance standards. And SPA is the space plug-and-play architecture work that started out as part of the Air Force Research Lab into modular open system architecture systems. And those are now available through AIAA for open consumption. And I think those standards, coupled with the mechanical and the physical standards of the CubeSat, are going to continue to invigorate the market to be able to come up with new and innovative ways of using these systems for Earth remote sensing, other things that people are using and thinking up through the crowdsourcing and the Kickstart programs and things like that. So I see it continuing to increase and grow that market or that market segment. What we have to be careful about is that, again, we are responsible in the orbit determination and where we put these things to be able to have safe rules of the road in LEO.
Listeners, if you're interested in what you're hearing and what Maureen, excuse me, Stan have to say, if you go to their website, which again is oak-arrow.com, and you go to contact, first they have a newsletter that you can subscribe to, which I just subscribed to, and they also give you the information on following them on Twitter if you're so inclined, which I will do when I get to a Twitter-enabled computer. And you can stay up on what they're doing, which is very exciting, and that also gives you a portal into the, I think, more professional side of a lot of the subjects that we talk about on the space show. And you'll get good information from people who know what they're talking about. Guys, it's been really great talking to you. Any concluding comments that either of you would like to offer for our listeners? And I hope next year we can sit down at a table there in the Utah State, whatever that room is that we use, and do this in person. So, but what about concluding comments or anything else you want to say about your company or the industry or the weather, for that matter, in Colorado?
Well, David, I appreciate you allowing us to come on and give some background and information. Appreciate the caller's comments. Bob, if you're still on, always interesting to talk more on those subjects as well as the launch subjects. From Charles. So I appreciate the time. I would recommend folks go check out the website. We try to keep it up as best as possible, nights and weekends with what we do on everything else. We are hiring, so there are employment opportunities on the website, and you can drop your resume directly into that. As you said, if folks are interested in intern opportunities, best to drop their line into the info@oak-arrow.com. But I just wanted to conclude with saying, David, the show is always good. Like to listen to the podcast and appreciate you guys taking the time to talk with us today.
Well, thanks, Dan, and it's been fun talking to you over the years, and now we get to follow you with this new development in Maureen as well. So that's really exciting. So we'll look forward to it. Now that I'm going to be getting your newsletter, I'll be able to keep listeners apprised as to what you're doing, and we'll look forward to the next time. Any concluding comments from you, Maureen?
Just kind of mirror what Stan said. Thank you very much to you and to the listeners. And I want to make sure I thank you for your help when I was putting together my presentation and introducing me to a couple folks when I did the presentation a year or so back.
On NEOS, right? Were they helpful?
Yeah. Very helpful. Yes, very helpful. So thank you very much for that.
That was Don Kessler, and I forget the other one.
Darren McKnight.
Darren McKnight. Yeah, great guys. Okay, well, we'll see each other next year in Logan, Utah, I hope. And if anything is exciting and you want to get an announcement out over the space show or something, don't hesitate to contact me, okay?
Great, thank you.
Thank you. So, Stan and Maureen, great, thanks. Have a great weekend coming up. And listeners, that's it for today's space show. Back again on Sunday. And then remember, no shows until Friday of next week. I'll be at AIAA in San Diego. And then Friday will be the archive shows from who I get to interview while I am at AIAA. Thanks again to Stan and Maureen and Oakman Aerospace. Everybody, keep your eye on it. Goodbye from the Space Show.